Good morning, Mr. Chan.
Good morning.
We are going to have an interview from the REDES, the Spanish Network of Development Studies. For the beginning, I'm going to ask you the first question. Mm-hmm. After 25 years working in development economics, how do you see the evolution in this field?
Mm. Well, I have been working on development economics a bit longer than that because I started my graduate studies specializing in development economics in 1986 in the University of Cambridge, England. So it's almost 30 years. And yeah, during those 30 years, development economics has changed quite a lot. I mean, the change has been complex, but if I summarize it, I would say it has become more neoclassical, more mainstream, because when development economics first started in the 1940s and 50s, it was actually started as a reaction against neoclassical economics, which tried to say that, well, you know, people are same everywhere, so why do you need a separate way of understanding the economies of poor countries? You know, what is good economics is that same in the United States as in Ghana or as in Brazil. Yeah? So the development economies of the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, they very much emphasize that, no, these countries have different history, they have different institutions, they even have different cultures, and you cannot just throw the theory developed in the United States or England or Spain at these countries and try to understand these countries well. Now, from the 70s, the neoclassical economists staged what the eminent British development economist John Toy called a counter-revolution. So these people came out saying, no, that was all wrong. We need to apply the same scientific principle called neoclassical economics to developing countries as well as developed countries. And this counter-revolution was at its height in the 1980s, because in the 1980s, a lot of developing countries, starting with the 1982 Mexican default, got into debt crisis. They had to go to the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank to get money. And the IMF and the World Bank said, okay, we'll give you money, but on the condition that you apply our policy, which were basically based on neoclassical theory that, yes, you need to liberalize the market, you need to open up to international trade, you need to welcome foreign investors, you need to privatize state-owned enterprises, and so on. And this counter-revolution was at its height in the 1980s. So I started in that environment. Of course, at the time, Cambridge Development Economics was still very non-neoclassical, so I learned different stuff, but around me, there was all this change going on. Now, that kind of a trend continued into the 1990s, but then by the mid-1990s, it was becoming clear that this kind of straightforward neoclassical policies were not working. All these structural adjustment programs failed in developing countries. And yeah, the mainstream economists working on development issues had to come up with another answer. And then from the late 1990s, they suddenly started paying attention to history, institutions, culture, which they, in the earlier times of the 1950s and 60s, denied were important. So now we are in a very curious situation where these neoclassical development economists, having denied that these things matter, are now trying to put these things back into development economics. And it doesn't quite work, because you have built this model assuming that, you know, people are all, you know, the self-seekers, and they're all rational, and they respond to price signals and so on, and then you are trying to put this back into, you know, these are things like history and institutions back into that model. So there's a lot of kind of intellectual incoherence there. But at least we are in a situation where even the mainstream development economists, neoclassical development economists, accept that, yes, actually these things matter. So let's hope that we have a more kind of intelligent conversation between the more traditional, more neoclassical development economies and neoclassical development economies, at least meet somewhere in between, so that we have to
forward some something.
That's right, take things forward.
Okay, some of your writings, such as Bas Mertens and Kicking Away the Ladder, were focused on industrial trade and the IKT policies. But more recently, in Rethinking Public Policy, the focus was on agricultural policies. What is the reason for this change? Not only because it's sponsored by the
FAO.
The FAO.
No, actually, it was partly accidental, because some people in the FAO, Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome, they approached me saying, can you review the agricultural policies of today's rich countries in the past in the same way that you reviewed the industrial policies of these countries? So my initial reaction was, oof, I don't know much about agriculture. It's an interesting idea, but I'm reluctant. But then they kept asking me, and then I realized, of course, manufacturing industry and agriculture have very different conditions, they need very different things, but at the general level, I mean, developing agriculture and developing manufacturing industry both share some fundamental principles, namely, I mean, the most importantly, the increase in the productive capabilities of the producers involved. Yeah? So it's not enough to give subsidies or give protection. You need to also invest in developing the productive capabilities, whether it is through investment in R&D or investment in worker training, as in the manufacturing, or it is through creation of agricultural cooperatives so that small farmers can pull their abilities together and do something that they cannot individually do. So I thought, okay, maybe there is some similarity. And also I thought, I mean, thinking along that line, I realized that maybe it is useful for someone like me to look at agriculture policies, because I'm not trying to criticize anything about people working on agriculture, but if you work on just one thing all the time, you sometimes lose sight of things, because you take certain things for granted and
focus too much.
That's right. So sometimes it's good to have an outside perspective. Yeah. So probably that would be also useful for someone who has worked on agriculture to look at manufacturing, and then they can identify different issues. And of course, this was supposed to be part of a bigger project which also reviews the agricultural policies of 10 or so developing and transition economies. I mean, the final volume, we had only space for 6 country case studies, but yeah, so it wasn't like totally independent, so that I could get complemented by this case studies of today's developing countries and transition economies in terms of their agricultural policy. So yes, I mean, it wasn't easy, because I had never really done any substantial work on agriculture, but I learned a lot from the process, and I think what we have as a final product is quite interesting, because no one has really looked at agriculture policy in this kind of way. I mean, very surprising, I found that today's rich countries, when they were poor economies, face the exact same problems as faced by today's developing countries. Farmers have no skills, they lack infrastructure, they don't have fertilizer, they don't have irrigation. The similarities are quite striking. But I think it was in the end quite a useful exercise for the FAO and for me. And, yeah, I thank the officials at the FAO who asked me to do this.
In 2014, you were considered to be one of the 10 most influential thinkers in the world by the Prospect magazine. What is your vision of the 2008 financial crisis?
Yes, 2008 financial crisis, I mean, of course, people feel it very, very painfully in countries like Spain, but, you know, I mean, this was the biggest financial crisis in the three generations, you know, after the 1929 Great Depression. And, I mean, this was basically caused by the creation of this very complex financial system that no one really fully understand and no one really controlled. And this was done, of course, at the lobbying of the financial industry, and I mean, it wasn't done overnight, but, you know, from the 1980s, there was a series of changes that made this financial system what it is today.
Even then free to operate.
That's right, yeah. So, you know, I mean, there were some very important developments. For example, in 1982, the U.S. Stock Exchange Commission and another commission dealing in the commodities trading agreed that, you know, in the old days, if you had things like options and futures and so on, these were all related to real transaction. So you buy an option to buy a certain amount of oil at a certain date, at a certain price and so on. But in 82, these two regulatory bodies agreed that actually these financial derivatives don't really have to be related to real transaction. So they said that you can, yes, create derivatives related to stock market index, you know, weather or real estate market price index and so on. And this opened a huge space for the creation of these financial derivatives, which are really no more than the casino betting. Yeah? I mean, these are not really related to, I don't know, the factories who have to buy a certain amount of oil at some future date, trying to protect themselves against price fluctuation. Yeah? So now you have created this derivative market, which became the tail that wags the dog, as the English speakers say. And then in the 1990s, a lot of European countries deregulated their financial market and accepted the creation of so-called asset-backed securities. You know, these are kind of assets created by pulling together loans. You know, so for example, in the old days, if you buy a house with a mortgage loan from the bank, the bank owns, I don't know, whatever, 70% of your house, and you own the rest, and you repay that, and it becomes yours. Yeah? So that the mortgage loan stays in the books of the bank. With the asset-backed securities, it became possible for the banks to pool all these mortgage loans and create a security and sell it to someone else. So this is what led to eventually the infamous CDO and CDO squared and all those financial products that were behind the collapse in 2008. And until the 90s, this was legal only in America. And in the 90s, a lot of European countries allowed this to develop. So you created yet another market, which is very complicated and which cannot be really properly regulated. And then in 1999, the Americans abolished the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933, introduced after the Great Depression, which forcefully separated investment banking from deposit banking on the ground that if these two are together, basically the investment banking arm can exploit the public insurance given to retail deposit through, you know, the federal deposit insurance schemes and so on. And in 1999, this was abolished. So, you know, these banks started merging and became really big and started taking excessive risk. And I mean, these are just three most important examples, but as a result, we have created this financial system, which is far too complex for anyone really to understand and control. And, you know, I mean, it's a bit like, the, you know, I don't know, creating this changing this car into having a lot of extra functions, you know, that are very complexly interrelated, and then, you know, getting rid of all these safety mechanisms like, you know, airbags and, you know, side impact bars and so on, and then having a crash and being surprised, you know. We have created this system that is going beyond our control, and it is very important, in my view, to make it simpler, make it more controllable. Otherwise, we can have another crash, you know, in the future.
You individually described the International Students Initiative for Pluralism in Economics. This initiative, which was supported by more than 100 research centers, criticized the lack of pluralism in the faculties of economics. What is a way to reach basic improvements in the academic training in economics?
Actually, in line with what the manifesto of ICIPE says, I think that there are three changes that need to be made. First of all is the pluralism. The recognition that there isn't just one correct economic theory in the way that there is one correct theory in physics or chemistry, because economics is based on a lot of assumptions about ethics and politics and institutions, and yeah, depending on what you assume, you can have vastly different theories. And they all have, I mean, the important things to say, but they all have weaknesses. So in recognition of that, students need to be exposed to a range of theory. Otherwise, you are creating this very narrow kind of perspective that is based purely on one theory. You know, I mean, they say that he who has a hammer sees everything as a nail. So you give students one theory, and then they'll start applying everywhere. So if you have a hammer, I mean, and start banging everything, I mean, it's great if you are banging a nail. If you are banging a screw, it could be a problem, yeah, but just about okay. It will be totally ineffective if you are banging a sponge, yeah? And it will be a disaster if you are banging an egg. Yeah? So you need to, I mean, as I say in my latest book, Economics, The User's Guide, which will be published in Spanish in May, I say that we need to give the students a Swiss Army knife. Yeah? They need a range of tools. And of course, they need the sense to judge what tool to apply where, which is why you need to study not just economics, but also ethics, politics, history, sociology, anthropology, and so on. Which leads me to the second point about economics reform, which is that it has to become more multidisciplinary or interdisciplinary. And actually, this interdisciplinarity is in the DNA of economics. Because at the beginning, economics was not called economics, it was called political economy, in explicit recognition that you cannot really separate economics and politics. The father of economics, Adam Smith, didn't just write a book on economics, the Wealth of Nations, but also wrote a book on ethics called The Theory of Moral Sentiment. You know, the founder of sociology, Max Weber, was actually a professor of economics. Karl Polanyi, the famous Hungarian economist, was also an anthropologist. He kind of created this new field of economic anthropology. And many economic theorists were also great economic historians, like Charles Kindleberger and all these people. So actually this interdisciplinarity is in the DNA of economics. Unfortunately, in the last few decades, all of these have been taken out because the mainstream economists wanted to make it into an exact science like physics or chemistry. And if you want to do that, yes, I mean, that you shouldn't really bring in things like politics and ethics because there's no clear conclusion once you include those things.
Focus on econometry. Sometimes.
Exactly, yeah. So basically concentrate on easily quantifiable things, yeah, so that you can build mathematical models and run regressions and so on. So this has to change. I mean, the students need to be exposed to these other disciplines in the same way that they need to be exposed to, for the same reason that they need to be exposed to different economic theories, because these different academic disciplines make you see the world in a different way. And I'm not saying that one way is necessarily superior to another. So you need to learn about these different ways of seeing things so that you can have a deeper understanding of the real world. And that, that leads me to my third point, which is that the students need to learn more about the real world. You know, it's quite amazing because these days students can graduate with an economics degree without even knowing what the GDP of their own country is, how big the world economy is, what proportion of that is produced by the United States or China. Of course, at one level, why do you need to know all these numbers? I mean, you need to know only one thing, Google. Yeah, you can Google anything, but even just to know what to Google, you have to have familiarity about the real, with the real world. When we make these criticisms, a lot of mainstream economists say, yeah, we also accept that students need to be told more about the real world, so we'll bring in more real world examples. But I think that's not sufficient, because unless that is complemented with the first two, theoretical pluralism and interdisciplinarity, the examples that you bring in are going to be only the ones that fit your theory. So students need to be taught about the real world in a systematic way from different perspectives. So that's why they have to learn about economic history. That's why they need to do some degree of comparative studies of different economies. You know, I mean, we talk about, say, capitalism, but there are many different types of capitalism. The American one is very different from the Japanese one, which is very different from the German one, which is very different from the Spanish one, and so on. So people need to know how the real world works to an extent, and also be told that you need different theories to fully understand the real world. I mean, I'll give you a beautiful example. Take the case of Singapore. You know, if you read about Singapore in the mainstream financial press, like, I don't know, the Wall Street Journal or the Economist magazine, or in standard books on economics, we'll only hear about its free trade policy and its welcoming attitude towards foreign investment, which it has. But you will never be told that 90% of land in Singapore is owned by the government, 85% of housing is provided by government-owned housing corporation, and 22% of GDP is produced by state-owned enterprises. I often put it to my students, give me one economic theory, it doesn't matter what it is, neoclassical, institutionalist, Marxist, give me one economic theory that can single-handedly explain Singapore, and there's no such theory. So you need to learn about the real world more, but with these different perspectives, and then learning about the real world should strengthen your kind of recognition that you really need different economic theories. You really need to learn different disciplines in order to fully understand the world. Because if you try to deal with this criticism that economics today is not related to the real world enough by simply saying, yeah, we teach the same stuff but bringing more examples, then you are going to still show them only one aspects of the real world. You are only going to ask questions that your theory was designed to answer, and that is not enough.
Over more than a decade of negotiation in the World Trade Organization, the Doha Round has barely achieved any real advance in the agricultural liberalization. In what way does this affect developing countries, and what are the main obstacles to reach an agreement, in your opinion?
Yeah, well, I mean, well, let's start the first get this straight. You know, I mean, the Doha Round, I mean, of course, it has many different elements, but it's basically based on this idea of agriculture industry swap, meaning that the developed countries are going to lower their agriculture protection by lowering tariffs and reducing subsidies, and in return, the developing countries are going to lower their industrial protection. Now, a lot of people think this is a good idea because, you know, I mean, after all, developing countries export agriculture, rich countries export manufacturing. However, this notion is based on a misperception. First of all, it's not as if this agriculture liberalization is really meant for the developing countries, because most of the agriculture protection in the developed countries is focused on what they produce. So it's mainly about wheat, beef, dairy, and things like that. And, you know, do you know any country that has a tariff against coffee or cocoa? No. Because they don't have any local producer to protect. So actually, the protection is mostly focused on these things. And very few developing countries actually are the main exporters of these things. So even according to the studies by the World Bank and so on, the main developing country beneficiaries of agricultural liberalization in the rich countries are going to be basically Brazil, Argentina, and Uruguay. Ghana's not going to export more
beef,
to European Union. Guatemala is not going to export more dairy to the United States. So this fight is really about a fight really between agriculture exporting developed countries like US, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, and agriculture importing developed countries like Japan, Norway, and Switzerland. So actually the most of the benefits of agricultural liberalization in the Doha round is going to go to the US, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, not to Ghana, not to Guatemala.
It's a fight between developing countries.
Exactly, yeah. It's a fight between developed countries, and it is sold as benefiting developing countries. And the developing countries are, in return, asked to liberalize their industry even more. And I mean, yeah, in the short run it might be beneficial, but in the long run, this is going to prevent their ability to industrialize. So in the long run, it's a really bad deal. So, I mean, actually, I think it is good that the Doha round, at least in the way that it has been proposed, is not coming to a conclusion, because it will be actually bad for developing countries. Now, this is not to say that we don't need to, you know, reform agricultural policies in the rich countries and so on, but, you know, Doha round has been completely misrepresented as benefiting developing countries by allowing them to export more agricultural products. It's not about that. So I think, in a way, it's a good thing that it hasn't come to fruition, but, you know, one main problem was that one main reason why this didn't come to fruition is because even within its own framework, the developed countries are demanding just too much. So basically they were trying to make developing countries almost entirely abolish their tariffs for industrial products. So the Americans are basically proposing to lower this on average to 5 to 7%. You know, I mean, this is
have no tariffs at all.
Yeah, basically, this is the no tariff regime. So within its own framework, the demands were so strong. A lot of developing countries said, "No, we are not doing this." So unfortunately, because this. The developed countries could not push this through the WTO. Now they are focusing on divide and rule. Now they are trying to sign and have signed many bilateral trade agreements with developing countries or regional agreements. And many of these bilateral and regional agreements are what people call WTO plus. It's even more restrictive than the WTO rules. So this is actually quite a sad consequence, but, you know, after all, the developed countries started to go around only because they thought they could bully developing countries when they found out that together they were too strong to be bullied, they have started engaging in divide and rule. So that is quite a sad situation.
And they're making it, it happens, and it, it's working for the developed countries.
That's right. Yeah.
In Spain, the multidisciplinary nature of development studies is not recognized by the actual scientific system, and this is the reason why Redes, Spanish network, was born. What is, in your opinion, the importance of multidisciplinary study of development process?
No, I think at one level, every subject has to be taught in an interdisciplinary way. I mean, I already described why. Even within economics, you need that interdisciplinary approach. But development is one area where you really need it, because you are looking at countries that have very different history, very different institutions, very different political system, very different culture, and so on, compared to the rich countries where all these economic theories come out. So, I mean, unless you understand these other aspects, you are not going to really understand these countries. So, I mean, I'll give you one personal example. You know, in the 1980s, I was studying economics in South Korea, and we learned macroeconomics with a textbook from America, written by Alan Blinder, the professor from Princeton. And yeah, in the textbook, we kept seeing this thing about the government bond market, so the treasury bills and the yield, and I couldn't really understand it, because at the time South Korea didn't have a government bond market. Government bond was basically hidden taxation. So the government would say, oh, if you're a patriot, you have to buy this because we need to build this new dam, new road, and a lot of people bought them, but they kept them in their cupboard. They were not selling them actively, and there were very few financial institutions. They were main buyers of these bonds. I'm sure that there was a government bond market, but it was not important at all. I mean, it wasn't part of your macroeconomic policy toolkit. But then we are taught this stuff, saying that this is how you manage the macroeconomy. So that's a personal example, but everywhere you look at, you need to understand why, for example, the people behave in a different way in developing countries compared to people in the developed countries, because they have different culture, different ethics, different family structure, different the economic system. So yes, development studies is where you really need this kind of interdisciplinary approach, because most of the theories in single disciplines are developed in the rich countries with certain types of institutions and culture and political system. Of course, a lot of people don't realize that they are building this theory assuming that these things exist. But then when you try to use it in developing countries, these theories do not work, whether it's in economics or sociology or whatever, because those assumptions do not hold. So development studies has been at the forefront of this interdisciplinary approach, at least from the 1960s. And in the countries like Britain or the Netherlands, this interdisciplinary approach is totally accepted among us scholars doing development studies. And I hope the Spanish academic community also accept this problem and encourage interdisciplinary studies in development.
Probably it's going to be a long run.
I'm not saying that these things will happen overnight, because let's face it, for academics, their ideas are basically the essence of their identity. So it's very difficult for academics to change their ideas. So it's not going to happen quickly. This is why Max Planck, the famous German physicist, said that science progress is one funeral at a time. So let's not have any illusion about the Spanish academy establishment changing its mind overnight and saying, yes, let's do interdisciplinary development studies, you know, from tomorrow. But you know, you have to keep making these points, and you have examples of very successful interdisciplinary development studies programs in the UK and the Netherlands and some other countries. So, it's not as if you are fighting a battle based on no real world experience.
That's really that's all. Thank you very much, Mr. Chan, for this time with us.